Today's program is brought to you by the Museum of Food and Drink, sparking curiosity about food with exhibits you can eat. For more information, visit mofad.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Good afternoon, Internet Radio. I'm Amanda.
And I'm Kim.
And this is Recommended Reading with Food Book Fair. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. We are coming to you live and alive from Heritage Radio Network in the back of Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, on this beautiful day, coming off of a long weekend of Food Book Fair 2017.
Yeah, you might notice we have a little more pep in our step, as they say, because we just finished our big event, Food Book Fair 2017, hosted by Ace Hotel New York. We had 4 days of meals, signings, authors,
panels, dinners, screenings. We were so hyped to be able to work with Chef April Bloomfield and her amazing team with the Breslin and John Dory, as well as all of our amazing presenters and speakers, one of whom we'll have on the show later today, Stephen A. Satterfield, the founder of Whetstone Magazine and aware of many other hats. But we'll get to that. But we'll do a little show and tell recap of Food Book Fair 2017, talk about what we liked, what we're hyped for the future, and of course, talk about what we're reading, watching, and listening to, because that's what this show is about. Amanda, what are you reading?
Oh, I was going to kick it off talking about something that I just can't get out of my mind from Food Book Fair 2017.
It's all connected, right?
Okay,
so
yeah.
Go for it.
I still just can't believe how fun Thursday night was. Our party that we hosted with the Film Collective On Plate, we screened one of their brand new films about the Haitian community in Montreal.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of wanted to create a very international vibe with the meal. So we collaborated with two chefs,
Andrew Gerson from Brooklyn Brewery and the bomb babe, Charya Un of Krung, Cambodia.
If you haven't tasted Char's food, you're really doing yourself a disservice, and you need to get yourself to Smorgasburg Saturdays in Williamsburg, and you can try it for yourself. But for anyone who was there on Thursday night, we sat on the floor. We
ate with our hands.
Some people did.
We took our shoes off.
We tasted some incredible beers from Brooklyn Brewery, including some ghost beers that have never been released before or released in extremely small quantities.
Even the alcohol by volume is unknown. Surprise!
I think it was probably known to people the next day. That's for sure. But you know, a little insider, you know, info was that I was actually kind of a little bit not worried, but I was thinking, like, are people going to want to, like, hang out on the floor, watch these movies, eat on the floor, drink on the floor, hang out? We couldn't get people to leave the floor.
People were lying down. It got real comfortable.
Like fully lying down.
I mean, I think that just goes to show how excited people are to engage and participate in the foodways and cultures and foodways and cultures of diasporas all around the world, and how that's something that's been really important to us to celebrate and amplify and create space and time for a food book fair. And we're so thrilled that our community and folks that want to get down with us are getting down with that.
Yeah. And so thanks to everyone who came out. So that's what Kim, was there anything that particularly stood out to you from the weekend?
I spend all my time now after Food Book Fair scrolling through our hashtag FBF2017 and hashtag foodieauticles, looking at people's hauls. H-A-U-L-S. You know how people do beauty tutorials and they show their like Sephora haul and like the makeup they bought or their Halloween candy or any other swag bag. We're particularly impressed and just really touched by people posting all of the foodie articles that they've bought and traded and bartered at the event.
If you're tuning in for the first time or haven't heard of hashtag Foodieoticals, that's our independent magazine fair within the fair that we hosted all weekend this past weekend. So independent magazines, such some of the more well-known ones include Cherry Bomb, who also have their own show on Heritage, and rest in peace, Lucky Peach, always. But we basically, all the magazines come, they get a table, all the makers and editors behind the magazines are there. You get to walk around, meet them, buy magazines and other magazine related swag. So when people show us their hauls on Instagram, we get so jazzed. So keep it going. Tag us.
We'll regram our favorites. Thank you at Zoe Maya and at Kia is Hungry. We've posted a couple of those already. And we also love at Chips Online. Hanari, we loved having you all weekend. She's a maker from South Africa that makes an amazing zine, and people were really, really digging her stuff. So you'll see some of that online when you scroll through.
Yeah, couldn't agree more, Kim.
If you could, like, also arrange it on a cool pattern bedspread or, like, a tablescape, you know, you can be creative with that.
Yeah, we will continue to regram those hauls and make sure you tag your favorite foodie article so people know who they are and we can spread the word about the amazing creative work that all of these magazines are able to do.
A lot of people have also been posting a combination of the magazines with books that they bought, which our friends at Kitchen Arts and Letters, they were our official pop-up bookstore partner in the lobby of Ace Hotel in New York all weekend. And looks like people have bought a lot of copies or got copies through events of Grocery by Michael Ruhlman, My Soul Looks Back by Jessica B. Harris, who also has a show on Heritage Radio Network. A lot of really good stuff. Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat by Samin Nosrat. She's everywhere right now. We loved having her on Friday night's panel, What We Talk About When We Talk About Eating.
If you make an Instagram with some food, some of the books, and some of the foodie articles, our heart will explode. So if you can combine all of those things, we will regram you and you will go in our regram hall of fame. We might even send you a book or two. So keep those photos going. We love, love, love seeing them.
Is there anything that you're reading that you picked up at Foodieoticals or at the bookstore?
Definitely. I picked up the latest copy of Cherry Bomb. Thank you so much, Carrie Diamond, for...
And Claudia Wu.
Yes.
Y'all are the best.
Carrie, thank you for being in conversation at our breakfast with Liz Pruitt and Chef April Bloomfield, celebrating Liz Pruitt's new book, Tartine All Day. And yeah, thank you, Claudia, for being at Foodieoticals and hanging with us. We cannot tell you how excited people are to see you both there. But speaking of the latest issue of Cherry Bomb, there's a brand new cover woman, Martha Stewart. I think Stephen's going to treat us to his feelings about Martha Stewart a little later when he comes on the show. So look forward to that. I mean, it's all good. I actually got right into the profile that Carrie wrote about the cover woman, Martha. And it was my partner in crime, Kim, who told me that this was actually a take on a 1966 Esquire magazine article. The opening was, which I will read briefly, where Gay Talese had to really track down Frank Sinatra to write about him. And he couldn't.
But spoiler alert. Yes. Frank Sinatra had a cold.
So this is the opening paragraph to the Carrie Diamond profile of Martha Stewart in the latest issue of Cherry Bomb. Martha Stewart has a cold. It's an off-brand moment for the polished lifestyle maven, but she is human after all. Susceptible to viruses like the rest of us. Even congested, however, Martha can't help being Martha. When an assistant walks into the conference room and places a cube of Kleenex tissues on the long table, Stewart winces at the tacky purple box. How awful, she says. Man, I wouldn't want to be that tissue box. I would be like shrinking into the conference table. But anyway, that's just the opening. It goes on.
Can't wait to read it.
Yeah, you got to read it. So, Kim, what are you reading?
I have been reading A Separation, the new novel by Katie Kitamura, who was one of our featured authors at Riverhead Table, our meet, greet, and eat event with Riverhead Books, featuring Katie and Emma Straub, another author we really love. I got this book before the fair, and I finally finished it afterwards.
Yay!
Lying horizontally this morning, wearing my Lil Debs Oasis crop top, Lil Debs Oasis being a dope restaurant in Hudson, New York, who had a booth at Foodiotical selling their zine, Hot Fridge.
Shout out to Lil Debs Oasis. You guys came with the ill setup. Let's be real. You really brought it.
And the best outfit selection.
By far.
It, also, if anybody bought any of the Lil Debs Oasis silk-screened t-shirts, tie-dye, crop tops, they made special shorts, tag us in that as well. We want to see that. We want to see you wearing those sweat shorts. So that's what I'm reading.
Cool. Well, I will end our segment of talking about what we're reading, watching, and listening to by talking about something that I'm not going to, no spoilers, but I've just been getting into Master of None.
Season two.
And let me tell you something. There's a lot of food in it. There's a lot of talking about food, and there's a lot of eating food in it.
What do they eat?
Well, the first episode, I really don't want to give too much away, but okay. I will say this.
I'm going to binge it all immediately after this radio show.
In the first episode, Dev goes to Italy, and he's actually living in Modena. And he's learning to make pasta. And all he's really been doing is making pasta morning, noon, and night. And then when he finally has some time off, Arnold, his friend, comes to visit him. And they get to go to a wedding, and they get to go on some incredible eating adventures. And I read a little bit about Aziz Ansari, the creator and one of the writer's motivations. And he said he just spent weeks watching the classic Italian cinema to see what parts of that he could infuse into Master of None. So I will say, if you liked season one, I think you'll love season two. And there's, like I said, tons of eating. There's one other funny part where Dev's trying to, you know, he goes on some online dating apps, and he, you know, swipes right and gets a lot of dates, and
right is for yes, right?
Right. In case you don't know. And he basically goes on the same date with all the girls, and it all starts at the Four Horsemen in Williamsburg. And that's his initial spot for starting the dates.
This is also where I take all the girls I meet.
Oh, good to know.
Just kidding, guys.
You can catch Kim there. But, you know, then, of course, Four Horsemen is known for their wine list and their natural wine list. So there's definitely wine, hashtag wine talk as well. So I highly recommend it. If you've watched it, you know, tweet at us. Tell us what you like about it at Food Book Fair, and we'll get the conversation going without giving too much away.
Next up, we'll definitely have more wine talk, ancient wine talk, with Stephen A. Satterfield. We'll talk a little bit about his new magazine, Whetstone, independent publishing, Detroit, Mexico City, a lot of different things, right after the break.
Hi, I'm Dave Arnold, the host of Cooking Issues on the Heritage Radio Network. We all know and love Chinese takeout dishes like General Tso's chicken and egg rolls, but here's the thing. Even though we call it Chinese food, it's not like the food you'd find in China. What's the story behind this cuisine, and how did it become so popular that you can find a Chinese-American restaurant in nearly every town in the country? The answers may surprise you. Visit the Museum of Food and Drink in Brooklyn and see our newest exhibition, Chow, Making the Chinese-American Restaurant. Chow engages visitors with compelling accounts of how Chinese immigrants overcame racism and created Chinese-American cuisine. Discover the science behind the flavors of your favorite takeout dishes, feast on rotating tastings developed by the country's most talented Chinese-American chefs, and try your hand at writing your own fortune, which will be baked into actual cookies by a 1,500-pound fortune cooking machine. But what better way to learn, connect, and eat? You can visit Chow at the Museum of Food and Drink on Fridays through Sundays from noon to 6. Tickets and more information can be found at mofad.org.
Welcome back. This is Recommended Reading with Food Book Fair with your hosts, Kimberly Chow and Amanda Dell, the directors of Food Book Fair. We're so excited to have with us today, live in the studio at Heritage Radio Network from the back of Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, Stephen A. Satterfield, food writer, multimedia producer, forager of origins. Welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm thrilled to be here.
Welcome to the show, Stephen. We've been talking about having you on this show since this show was just an idea. We were like, we must have Stephen on. He's the perfect person.
2 weeks ago?
Yes. No, we've been talking about this show
for a while. It's been a long time coming.
Yeah.
Okay.
And congratulations on Whetstone.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. I am so relieved that it's done with and ready for the next one.
If you haven't heard of Whetstone, highly recommend checking out Stephen's brand new foodie article covering food origins. And you can check them out on Instagram at Whetstone Magazine, which we'll link to their website. And it's also in print. Stephen, can people pick it up anywhere or how can they get it?
Yes, I just sent out over 100 copies this very morning. And if you're in New York, I will meet up with you. I'll give you one. No, I won't give it to you, but I'll meet up with you. But yeah, we're shipping nationwide, worldwide, to Estonia as well.
Damn.
I know.
Wow. Whetstone is on that worldwide tip. Okay. You can get it all around the world. Amazing. And your magazine really is about the origins of food around the world.
Truly. So
tell us a little bit about the inspiration behind it.
Well, my background is as a sommelier, as well as just a general lover of food and food culture. So I worked in restaurants for a really long time, and a very familiar and common part of the sommelier narrative is about terroir, the place where the wine is really born of and from. And I just sort of applied the same ideology to everything around food. And so far as I wanted to know, not really the terroir, so to speak, but the very beginnings of the things that we eat and drink. And so the magazine is a reflection of that.
Okay. Awesome.
Are there any particular stories in this first issue that you had been thinking about?
Yes.
Before it actually became actualized, or any stories that turned into a different story than you expected?
Yeah. So the main, at least as far as my contribution, I have two stories in the magazine. They are both about Mexico. I have a profound love affair with Mexico. It's pretty widely known by people who know me. And the most prominent one is a story about maize, so corn. And it really was inspired by Gonzalo Guzman of Nopalito Restaurant in San Francisco, who actually also just came out with a beautiful book just last month, I believe. And it was really an opportunity for me to look at something so ubiquitous like corn in every way of our lives, and establish a connection to a way of life and a diet that was here 8,000 years before we were, even longer, some say. And so as we talk about food in a more conventional or contemporary sense, I think it's important to move beyond, let's say, the last one or even few centuries, and really consider, as I say, where the things we eat and drink come from.
So with that, is there one thing that, I mean, aside from everyone picking up Whetstone and reading the article, is there really one thing that particularly stands out that you would want people to know about corn or think about it in a different way? Or how can they begin to explore
corn
more?
Yeah, I think one of the main things to note is that if you're talking about indigenous corn, it's basically a completely new landscape. I'm sure many people here in New York are familiar with the work of Macienda in bringing heirloom varieties of corn from Mexico, indigenous corns of Mexico, into the U.S. So in that, you are afforded a completely new vocabulary as a chef, as a diner, new flavors, new regions, new stories beyond the predominantly monocrop corn that we eat. Of course, that's grown for fuel and all kinds of other things. So that's one thing. But the thing that I really vibe out with is that, something as simple as a salsa and tortilla has been a revered snack for several thousand years, 5,000, 6,000 years ago. That's what people were doing with maize. They were grinding peppers and pumpkins and pumpkin seeds and nixtamalizing corn and eating and rolling up little tortillas with salsa for their daily voyages. So I just think it's kind of amazing that we have such a direct lineage in our own foodways with such ancient cultures.
I think in some ways it's almost reframing contemporary thinking about how far we go back.
Exactly.
And the sort of deep time
exactly.
of a specific food or a specific place that some folks do think about, but not everyone thinks about. And sometimes even us, we folks who think about it a lot, I think, forget to.
Yeah.
Or don't go as far back.
No, there's so much to learn. I mean, a lot of my research was predicated on visiting seed banks and really talking to people who are the keepers of these very, very old traditions, and this ancient wisdom, this ancient knowledge is really what I was drawn to because of the agricultural adaptivity and harmony to be able to cultivate something that started off as basically a blade of grass into the most productive plant in the world that we've totally taken for granted. As much as corn is a part of the conversation of genetics, you have to also consider the birthplace of agriculture was in Mesoamerica. And so the technology that we look to now in agriculture is from the last century, but the real birth and growth and development of human beings cultivating crops for sustenance is many, many thousands of years old.
Right. And there was a word you had used in when you were speaking just a little bit earlier, nixtamalized corn. Can you talk a little bit more about what that means? Because it's something even for myself, I hear the word thrown around, and I know it's kind of an important term or process in how we're eating corn today, how we've eaten it in the past, what it means for the future.
So it's basically you are breaking down using alkaline to break down the corn itself, and it helps improve the digestion, so it retains a higher nutritional value. And people use things like ashes in the past to nixtamalize corn. So you can add lye, different solutions to break it down. But basically the value is that it's an improvement in terms of the health benefit. That's the prevailing benefit.
Got it. Well, I mean, it seems like corn is something we could talk about for a long, long time.
Yeah, I invested the better part of last year doing that, so I understand if we're ready to move on.
No, we're. Leave us with some. What's your favorite thing to eat with corn? We'll leave it with that, if you can narrow it down.
We were just talking about the great depth and breadth of tacos last night when we were hanging out, and I would find it hard to choose, but.
Yeah.
Not my question.
No, I think it's got to be the taco. Or basically, to me, it's just a vessel for the most delicious thing available. And oftentimes, that's an avocado. I like avocado with corn tortilla product. Hard to go wrong.
Sounds good. Well, next time we have you on the show, we'll be expecting you to bring that for us.
Oh, I thought you were going to offer me chips and guac.
Oh, chips and guac. That's the other version of that. You're totally right. Okay, we can arrange that.
One of us will bring chips and guac.
We'll make sure we have it.
Well, speaking of ancient tools and ancient processes and ancient foods, we know you've been traveling a lot all around the world, and you're originally from Georgia, but you were just recently in the other Georgia.
It's very confusing. Not as confusing as being named Stephen Satterfield, though.
Yes, we're finally getting into it.
Sorry, was that a topical thing?
No, both Stephen Satterfield, the Stephen Satterfield, the chef of Miller Union.
With a V.
In Atlanta, and our guest today, Stephen with a PH, A. Satterfield, were actually both at Food Book Fair this past weekend.
You just lost half your listeners.
I know. My dreams were realized. Okay, we'll just throw it out there. They're both two different people, and they both exist. And we are huge fans of both of them.
I'm huge fans, too. he's the reason I had to leave Atlanta. So I am from Georgia, and I went to the Republic of Georgia for the second time. I just returned. And the purpose of the trip is pretty much part of the same consistent narrative, which is exploring the birthplace of wine and viticulture, which happens to be the Republic of Georgia. The first time I went was in the fall of 2015, and I was so overwhelmed by the experience. I didn't really write about it. I took a lot of notes. But I just knew that I needed to get back there. So this trip was more, I think I was prepared to really ask the right questions, and still not sort of impose my questions on the experience, but, I think just be more targeted in the kind of information I was looking for and the kind of experience I was looking for.
So a lot of the trip was about exploring Georgian wine.
Yeah, so I'll give you a prominent highlight.
Great.
We went to the southern part of the country in a region that I'm reluctant to try to say because I will butcher the name. Lots of consonants, I can tell you that. Some Sketi in a cave, in an old cave village called Varzia. That's like the outlying region. Anyway, we met a winemaker there named Georgi Natanzadze, and he grew up in a village that had, during the Ottoman Empire, hundreds of different indigenous grapes from his village. And his father and grandfather told him that during their occupation, they destroyed many of the indigenous grapes, and now that Georgia had maybe about like a fifth of those grapes, if that, remaining. So he's a young man, he's probably like in his mid-30s, and spent the last decade taking it upon himself to find and restore these indigenous grapes. And his methodology for that is basically just being a Tarzan and going deep into the forest and the mountains of his village, climbing up trees, and the vines, because some of these vines are, I actually met a 400-year-old grapevine. It's one of the most euphoric experiences of my life, but they grow straight up the tree, and so it's not like you know, Napa or Sonoma, where you would expect to see, obviously, like, they haven't been trellised or manicured to grow in a particular way. They're just growing their vines. They're just growing straight up these trees. So they look like trees themselves. Mm-hmm. And so he's got to shimmy really high up these trees to discern which one is, you know, multi-hundred-year-old grapevine and which one is actually the tree. So one of the real highlights for me as a wine professional, but as just a curious human being, like, it was just a really, I think it's actually the oldest, producing vineyard in the world in terms of wine production, because we then later drank the wine that came from this 400-year-old vine.
What does the wine from a 400-year-old vine, or this wine from this 400-year-old wine, taste like?
It's really hard to separate my enthusiasm for the experience, I think. Like, I know that I can't be completely objective, but Georgie's style of making wine is really natural. I mean, Georgians are sort of famous. You guys have probably even seen, like, orange wines and the wines that are made from the clay amphora vessels. So his wines are sort of reminiscent of that. Very hands-off with a lot of techniques that would make most Western winemakers really ancient. But what ends up happening is you're left with wines that are really complex, a little more subdued and intellectual, and often with really rich textures, but tons of character, tons of style, totally original wines. Mm. Delicious.
And what's the current wine culture, or the more recent wine culture in Georgia, in the Republic of Georgia? Like, do people drink wine with meals? Is it an integral part of their life?
It is such an integral part of their life.
Okay.
And in that way, I really fit in like a natural. It felt like my actual home of Georgia. The Georgians in general are just kind of really badass people. They're super strong. They're really tough. A lot of them come from really cold places. And a lot of them have lived through a Soviet era that was really unkind to Georgia. And mm-hmm. in some ways continues to plague a lot of the citizens of the country. So the drinking of wine there is about what you would expect from such a population of people. It's not done to get messed up, but it's ubiquitous.
Okay.
One of the funny things about drinking a lot of wine in Georgia, which everyone grows their own grapes, everyone makes their own wine. It's mostly consumed out of 2-liter jugs of plastic water bottles or Coke bottles. And it's got this really mainly rich, bright yellow, not bright, more like amber yellow hue to it. That's pretty much the going drinking wine. And they don't drink water with wine. And more than once, I was ridiculed for asking for water in the midst of a 3 or 4 hour meal. And they love toasting. Anything is an occasion to toast, which I really subscribe to.
I know your birthday was spent there, so I hope they toasted you.
We toasted so much. Yes. Lots of things to toast. It was wonderful. I love it. It's not easy to get to. You got to really want to be there, but especially for wine people, I think it just really helps complete a lot of the tale of, what we love and enjoy about wine.
Yeah.
Wow. Can you tell us, was there any... Well, this is also a question connected to the fact that you are someone who makes media, you write, you make videos, podcasts, but we'd love to hear more about what you are consuming, what you read, watch, and listen to. And was there anything during your travels or in the lead up to prepare yourself or to inspire yourself for things you encountered there in Georgia or elsewhere?
Exactly. So that's pretty much how or what I've been reading has been predicated on where I've been going. I just returned from Cuba. I spent a week and a half there. So I've been reading Fidel Castro's autobiography, and just some of his, transcripts from his, court appearance after really the onset of the Cuban Revolution. That has been interesting, I think, for me in a lot of ways.
How so?
Well, I know interesting is a cop-out word.
It just intrigues radio listeners.
Yeah. No, I think... So when I got back, the first thing that I saw was our FBI director being fired.
Mm-hmm.
As our current president is under investigation. And it just made me think that, a lot of places and processes that we are unfamiliar with are imperfect, mm-hmm. certainly, but we are also imperfect. And I think learning more about different political infrastructures, different challenges that people have faced in modern and deeper history, really helps me have more empathy for the world, for our nation and for many nations, because people people suffer everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think there's any perfect answers, but it's really interesting reading about a government and an ideology that was so diametrically opposed to the one that we're used to.
Mm.
Or even ones that we're used to. Anyway, so I'm reading that. And then I've been reading a lot of poetry from like Georgian poets. I bought a book of On the Streets in Tbilisi. There's a book of like art and poetry. And it was, of course, translated. There's just like a number of different poets whose mm-hmm. with names, again, I just don't dare try to pronounce. But
if you keep traveling there, I'm sure your Georgian will get better.
I'm sure, but it's not intuitive. If anyone's ever heard Georgian, it's not an easy language. That's what I'm consuming. And then I'm reading a lot of scripts. I'm working on a script right now. So reading my own voice for voiceover, spending a lot of time trying to make as much, if not more, than I'm consuming.
Mm. Cool. Well, it sounds like you're also listening to a few things, speaking of Georgian language.
Yes, listening to...
polyphonic singing?
Ah, of course. I missed the alley-oop right there.
Sorry.
I was supposed to dunk that. No, that was not your fault. Yeah, polyphonic singing is really...
We're just having you on because you mentioned you've been listening to polyphonic singing, and I wanted to take us on this tangent.
Oh, I thought maybe we were going to be treated to a singing performance.
Oh, that would really be something.
Got to work on those consonants.
The other half of listeners would be gone.
Is anyone still here?
Yeah. Song in Georgia is almost like another language. And each region of the country, they have sort of their own style of song. The ones that I saw usually transpired over supras, these really elaborate, not even really multi-chorus, because it's just perpetual table full of food. But, you know, after everyone's well lubricated, we've toasted like 100,000 times. They also think that guests are a blessing from God. So this is a 90% Christian population. And so a lot of the way that they show their faith or live out their faith is in hosting people really well. Mm. So I was there on Easter, which is like basically, you know, that's a big day.
Right.
I don't need to break that down. And so I got a really fascinating up close and personal with the already famous Georgian brand of hospitality, but the sort of like pinnacle of that, I guess, over Easter. And so there was some song, and the song is, I don't know the correct definition, but basically it's a style of harmony that both the men and the women engage in. It's really beautiful, but you're kind of singing two notes at one time. It's like a better sound. It's like a yodel, but like mm-hmm. really controlled. And it's like a lot of people doing these high and low pitch yodeling sounds in tandem.
Wow.
And it has this like very beautiful, cavernous but angelic quality to it. Best YouTube it and not listen to me try to stumble over.
So there's this song, there's the food, there's all the wine, and then there's the toasting.
Yes.
All blessings from God.
All praise be.
Yeah. Sounds pretty rad.
Can't wait to see the fruits of your travels.
Yeah. Do you think it's coming back to Whetstone, do you think you'll be writing about that for a future issue?
That'll definitely be part of our next edition. But I was also there with a dear friend of mine who is a filmmaker. And some of these stories and some other stories that are even just too mind-boggling to engage in this format, we're going to present to the world in some fashion.
Wow.
We don't exactly know where yet, but that's what the aforementioned voiceovers are for. We're working really hard on putting something together.
Can't wait to see it. Just we just have a couple more minutes to, I just wanted to dive back into Whetstone and talk about the format of it. You have obviously articles, you know, reportage, but also photographs and illustration. So why were all of those important for you to put in Whetstone?
Because I think that I really just believe in art, and of course reported media is reported and it needs to be rooted in some fact and sensibility. But what we really are trying to do is just get people to engage and to get people to think more deeply about food. And of course, art is an incredible opportunity to make that happen. And I live in Oakland, and we have so many artists in the Bay Area who are living the lives of people in food in many ways. I think it's very common for people in art to sort of have their own relationships or a certain understanding about the life of people who work in kitchens or work in, I guess, a more alternative setting. But in terms of wanting to have that in there, I want to support the artists, but I just want to help people connect in ways beyond just pictures and words.
Well, it's a feast for the eyes. So
thank you.
Multiple senses.
Yes.
Many, many senses.
Yes.
So again, please check them out. It's Whetstone Magazine, at Whetstone Magazine.
Yep, at Whetstone Magazine, whetstonemagazine.com. I will send you a magazine, and we can't wait to make more. We're already working on the second edition.
Yeah.
That's how it is.
And you can follow Stephen. His handle is I Saw Stephen with a PH.
Yes.
ISAWSTEPHEN. So find him.
Yeah. So beyond the next Whetstone and the other projects that you're cooking up, can you tell us where else you're traveling, where else you're going, and what else are you reading or trying to read or listen to or watch?
And also, you're not escaping this show without your ode to Martha. So I just want you to know that.
Okay, yeah.
Gotta leave us with that. Yeah.
I would never disrespect her. I'm going to Detroit.
Cool. Woo.
Allied Media Conference. I am so honored to have been invited to help put together a conversation there, a workshop there. I know, Kim, you will also be there.
I'll be there, too.
So I'm very much looking forward to working with you. But, yeah, food and media, and we'll be talking about important topics in food and media, namely inclusion and access. Mm-hmm. And so we have not really a panel. It's going to be a bit more interactive, but we will have people who are very active in the social issues and social movements within the food space, and really pair them up with people who are, or I should say, more diverse voices in media, and really see, what we can produce from that collaboration.
Cool. Building the food media that you wish to see.
I am the change I want to see.
So if you're in Detroit or you want to get to Detroit, June 15th through 17th, Food Book Fair, I Saw Stephen, Whetstone, yeah. We'll be repping at AMC.
For sure. I'm really excited. You guys should check out the website to see the breadth of just thinking and creativity that this conference has a very long tradition of producing. It's not really like a food thing per se, so I'm really, really honored in talking about art and activism.
Mm-hmm.
There's just some amazing thinkers and artists who've been involved historically, so I'm really flattered.
Media for a change is something we definitely can all dig and agree on. So
true. Okay, so
wax poetic about Martha.
I know,
to take us out. I can't wait.
Perfect outro.
Stephen's a great friend of ours. I can't wait. We've never spoken about this, and I can't wait to...
I'm surprised this has not come up in our friendship.
Yeah, well, so I'm on wax for a very long time of saying that I love Martha Stewart. Going back to high school...
Oh, wow.
So I used to watch Martha after school every day. I watched her put flowers together. I watched her really organize her home to receive company like the boss host that she is. And I was really into entertaining. I was really into hosting people. I was really into cooking. And this was obviously before I thought I'd be doing something like this for a living. But I was like, this lady, she just kills it. She just knows how to do everything. And so after marveling at her for probably like my senior year, I read a biography about her. And I was all in. I learned about her days as a model, her killing it on Wall Street, taking down all the men who were hating on her, who thought they could outsmart her, outmuscle her. She's just so damn tough and tenacious, and she's been doing it for so long at such a high level, against obviously greater odds than any man would have to face under the same set of circumstances. And I know that it's funny now and for everyone to love Martha because she's got a show with Snoop and she's 75. But everything I ever read, like, for instance, the perfect antidote that you gave earlier, as soon as I heard Kleenex, I knew where her head was going to be, because I cringe in the same way, because I think that, you know what, if that's your job for Martha Stewart, like, how are you not going to know that she's going to cringe at that Kleenex box? You know, like, I just think that she's been so consistent about her worldview and what she thinks is proper, and her instincts are almost unfailingly on point. So I'm so down. And she's a media mogul. She's a great chef, cook, what have you. She is an excellent gardener. Like, she's life goals for all of us. So do you want more? I have so much more.
Have you ever met her?
No.
Okay.
Can we make that happen?
Hey, we will stop at nothing so that Stephen A. Satterfield and Martha Stewart can meet. You heard it first here on Recommended Reading with Food Book Fair. We'll make it happen.
That should happen. She's fantastic. I mean, even though I've heard stories, but I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.
Okay.
That's way better than giving our recommended reading for next week's show, this challenge.
Go read the biography so you can learn about her Wall Street days.
I can't wait. I'm putting it on my reading list as soon as
I'm actually writing it down.
I'll be going to the library to get it later. Yep, that's right. I still take books out from the library, but that's what this show's about. So again, Stephen Satterfield, thank you so much for being our guest this afternoon. Thank you for sharing Whetstone with Food Book Fair.
My pleasure. Thank you for
making it.
I'm thankful to have made it. But yes, thanks to both of you ladies for the opportunity and for this and the many other platforms you're always providing me with and people like me. Without you, it would be very lonely and quiet with our creative endeavors. So thank you.
Yeah, we're all in this together.
Truly.
There's room for everyone at the table.
Right on.
Again, thanks for listening. We would love it if you would go on to heritageradionetwork.org, click on that beating heart, support Heritage Radio Network so we can keep Recommended Reading and all the other incredible shows on the air.
Until next time, this is Kim.
I'm Amanda.
We're Food Book Fair, and we'll see you next Tuesday at 2 p.m.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.